Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When did the United States become the wealthy, powerful, and diverse nation it is today? For almost a century after the United States gained independence, it remained a land of mostly small farms and small businesses, proud and hardworking, but hardly the envy of the world. But in the decades following the Civil War, a number of remarkable events and individuals coalesced to change the economy, the population, and the very culture of the nation. H.W. Brands is here to talk about it. He's Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is called American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900. H.W., welcome back to Think.
Nice to talk to you, Chris.
A recurring theme of this book is this tension between democracy and capitalism, which I think is fascinating, especially given that as a society, we have never really believed that these two things might be mutually exclusive.
Well, in fact, yeah, that's one of the things that led me to write this book. Some while ago, I realized that there was this fascinating coincidence in American history. In 1776, the manifestos or charters of the two institutions and value systems that had come to characterize American life were both published to the world. One was the obvious one, the Declaration of Independence in 1776. The other was Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which was published in Great Britain. And at the time, no one saw much connection between the two. But gradually, over the course of the 19th century, America emerged as this combination of a democratic political system and a capitalist economic system. But it was a long process. It was an often difficult process. And I came to appreciate that whereas democracy and capitalism are generally hailed in 4th of July style rhetoric as two sides of the same coin of individual liberty, mm-hmm. and so that they would seem to each one promote the other. In historical practice, they have as often been at odds and in tension as they have been in cooperation. And so I wanted to see how these two institutions evolved and how this tension played out over time. And that was the origins of my new book, American Colossus.
Well, let's lay the foundation here. Talk about what the United States was like economically, socially, geopolitically at the end of the Civil War.
Well, at the end of the Civil War, the United States was on the verge of an industrial revolution. We actually have to back it up a little bit before that in order to get the clear distinction. But in the first half of the 19th century, from 1800 to 1850, this was an age when America's economy was overwhelmingly agrarian. Most people were farmers or made their living relatively close to the soil. People lived in small towns, and the entire scale of life was face-to-face, personal, and rather small. And this was the era in which democracy took hold. It's the age of Jacksonian democracy. It was the time when Americans, for the first time in their history, acknowledged that political power ought to be exercised by ordinary people. So as of 1850, the principle of democracy had been pretty well accepted. Now, the practice still had some work to be done. Women couldn't vote, African Americans couldn't vote, but nonetheless, you no longer had to be special. You no longer had to be aristocratic, wealthy, well-educated in order to exercise the vote. So democracy, which continues to characterize American life, is pretty recognizable by 1850. But capitalism, this is something that really only emerges in the second half of the century. And in 1850, the country was still largely agrarian. By 1900, it has become largely industrial. And the pace of life has shifted. The context in which Americans operate has shifted. I call the period from 1865 to 1900, the period of America's capitalist revolution, because these changes were indeed revolutionary, and they covered all aspects of life, starting with economics, to be sure, but spreading into life of American society, American culture, American foreign policy, just about everything that touched American life.
You open the book with the story of J.P. Morgan, who undoubtedly had a great head for business. He also, though, happened to be born at exactly the right time to make his fortune.
This is one of the key aspects of understanding this period, but it's a principle of history generally. There is a whole lot of good timing that is involved in the success of particular individuals. J.P. Morgan was smart. J.P. Morgan was ambitious. But if J.B. Morgan had been born 30 years earlier, he would not have had the career he had. But Morgan was the person, more than anyone else, who understood the role of money and finance in the emerging capitalist economy. And although Morgan was never really wealthy by the standards of Andrew Carnegie or John Rockefeller, in fact, when Morgan died in 1913, Carnegie was still alive, and they learned that Morgan was worth around $50 million. And Carnegie sort of shook his head, mystified, saying, and to think he was not a rich man. But he was exceedingly influential because Morgan had his finger on the pulse of finance. And Morgan was the one who put together the big mergers, the big deals, who created the great trust, that was the term of the day, for monopolies. It was Morgan who oversaw the reorganization of the railroad system. It was Morgan who, in 1895, orchestrated a private bailout of the public treasury. And this is worth reflecting on just for a moment to show how different life was in the 1890s from what it is today.
Sure.
In 2008, it was the federal government that rescued the J.P. Morgans, that rescued the private sector. In 1895, it was the private sector, J.P. Morgan, who rescued the public sector, the U.S. government.
What does it say about the balance of power in those years and these?
I contend that by 1900, the United States was more capitalist than it had ever been in its history, and more capitalist than it would ever be again in its history. Because I look on democracy and capitalism, these two institutions and sets of values that are in kind of tension, often creative tension, and that's one of the aspects of this whole thing. But you can also look at it in terms of a pendulum. And so the pendulum in the first part of the 19th century swung in the direction of democracy. The pendulum in the late 19th century swung in the direction of capitalism. Now, the reason for the tension is that capitalism and democracy work on fundamentally different mechanisms, and they use and require fundamentally different values. Democracy, the way we operate our political system, is based on the principle of equality. Everybody gets one vote. Nobody gets more than one. Nobody gets less than one. It doesn't make any difference if you're really smart or really stupid. You get one vote. It doesn't make any difference these days if you're rich or you're poor. You get one vote. You can be beautiful. You can be ugly. You can be ambitious. You can be lazy. You just get one vote. In the capitalist world, on the other hand, the principal value, the driving force, is inequality. And we think nothing of the fact that brain surgeons, hedge fund managers, movie stars make hundreds, thousands of times what ordinary day laborers make. And that's just the way it works. Why does it work that way? Because a capitalist system is designed to identify those people with unusual talents and make sure they do those particularly important functions. And so people are naturally born with different talents. Alex Rodriguez is a better baseball player than just about anybody else. And there are people who are good bankers. There are people who are good musicians and all the other things. And so they start with unequal talents, and they are rewarded unequally. And so the fact that some people are really, really rich and other people aren't is just the way our capitalist system operates. But you can readily see that there is a kind of tension between the equality of democracy and the inequality of capitalism. And especially during the late 19th century, there was a fear that the growing inequality of the capitalist world was bleeding over and was infecting the equality of the democratic realm. And in the 1880s and 1890s, there were political movements that arose challenging the basis of capitalism and especially the inequality it spawned, and demanding that democracy reassert its authority in the public sphere.
Are you surprised that we're not seeing similar calls now when everybody gets one vote, rich or poor, but certainly if you've got money, you can buy a lot more influence, a lot more time with a politician? It's a different playing field.
When I said that the pendulum swung in the 19th century from democracy in the first half to capitalism in the second half, It swings back toward democracy in the first half of the 20th century. And so although I call the period from 1865 to 1900 the period of the capitalist revolution, I have an epilogue that introduces the first part of the 20th century, and I call that the democratic counter-revolution. So the pendulum swings back toward democracy. But then, in the late 20th century, definitely by the time Ronald Reagan is elected in 1980, the pendulum is shifting again toward capitalism. Now, I don't know exactly where we are in the pendulum swing at this point. We may, 5 years from now, 20 years from now, look at the financial meltdown of 2008 and say that was the high tide of this, or that was the high point of this swing of the pendulum toward capitalism. Things haven't really cleared themselves up yet. And I actually did expect to see more outrage and more persistent outrage at what capitalism had led the country into. Certainly there were plenty of angry people in 2008, but at least so far they weren't able to mobilize that anger. In part, Barack Obama is a president who doesn't appeal to that angry streak in people. If there had been a different president, there might have been a different outcome. But this is bigger than just presidents. Now, I think one thing that may actually contribute to this notion that we've got to get back more toward equality was the Supreme Court decision last year in the Citizens United case that said that corporations can contribute just as much money as they want to political campaigns. And that overturned a century-long tradition. In fact, this rule, this law, was established at the end of this Gilded Age period that I'm talking about for precisely the reason that people then thought corporations had too much political power. They weren't that concerned about the economic power of corporations, but when the corporations began exercising political power, that seemed illegitimate. Now that we've got this new decision by the Supreme Court, and we have yet to see how it's going to play out, but at least in the spending on this particular campaign, corporations are pouring money into the campaign, often in ways where it's impossible to tell where the money is coming from. And I think this really will get people upset, because Americans have had great tolerance for inequality as long as it remains in the economic realm. This has never been a country that responds to calls for class warfare on economic grounds. But once you start to undermine the political system and say that the rich folks, corporations, have enough political power to stifle the interests of everybody else, then I think there will be a democratic, small d, democratic political backlash.
Well, let's jump back into the 19th century here, because you have a great explanation of how Wall Street became what we know today. It existed long before this time that we're speaking about, but it was basically about trading commodities, things like cotton and cattle, and then technology allowed that to start to change.
Technology and some reinterpretations of old legal principles. The technology included preeminently the railroad. The railroad was introduced into the United States in the 1830s. It had spread in the North by the 1850s, but it didn't go nationwide until the 1860s and 1870s. The first transcontinental railroad linking the East Coast to the West Coast was completed in the spring of 1869, and it took even longer for that for railroads to penetrate all through the South, because until the end of the Civil War, until the end of the slave system, the South wasn't fully integrated into the national economy. But railroads allowed companies to build factories that could serve a national market. Railroads linked the whole nation together, giving those people who controlled the railroads and those people who controlled the money that drove the railroads greater scope for expanding their operations.
Let me have you pause right there, because
sure,
we need to take a quick break. H.W. Okay. Brands is my guest. His new book is called American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is H.W. Brands. He is Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's got a new book out called American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900. So you were talking before the break, H.W., about the fact that railroads allowed for a very different kind of manufacturing capacity in this country, and then we also had the telegraph.
Right. The telegraph provided communication, and with the telegraph did something that had never been done in human history until that point. It allowed the separation of communication from transportation. Until that time, if you wanted to get a message from point A to point B, something physical had to go from point A to point B, and therefore was limited by how fast things could move physically. But the telegraph allowed things to travel at the speed of electricity, which is effectively the speed of light. People could communicate at a distance instantaneously. One of the first things it did was to knit New York to the rest of the country financially, so people could know what was going on in the rest of the world. And when a telegraph line cable was laid under the Atlantic Ocean, it linked New York to London. One of J.P. Morgan's secrets of his financial power was his ability to enlist British capital in support of American projects. There were some other aspects of this emerging new economy, and this relates to something we were talking about a moment ago, about how the Supreme Court recently re-acknowledged that corporations are legal individuals and therefore have free speech rights, which cannot be infringed. Well, it was in the late 19th century that the courts ruled that corporations were individuals and they had property rights like individuals. Until the middle of the 19th century, modern corporations, as we know them, didn't exist. Corporations, in fact, were something quite new. They were something novel, and they were critical to this revolution in American capitalism. Because the essence of a corporation, and technically they're called limited liability corporations, people who want to start up a business don't have to put their entire personal fortune at risk. Prior to this time, if you went into a partnership, if you wanted to conduct some business with somebody else, this, that, or the other thing, and you put your name on the contract, if the company lost money, your creditors come and seize your personal property. But with corporations, you were only on the hook for as much as you put into the corporation. And so it allowed individuals to take risks in a way they hadn't before. And there had been corporations fashioned one by one in the early 19th century, but general incorporation laws, essentially a set of rules, and if you meet these requirements, then you can incorporate. It's worth noting that these incorporation laws, they were initially seen as exclusive charters granted by government for the operation of business. And in fact, one of the fundamental facets of this capitalist revolution of the late 19th century was the positive support that the capitalist system got from the government. In the last 50 years or so, business leaders have generally tended to advocate less intrusion of government into the private sector. But in fact, in the 1860s and 1870s, the federal government, and especially the Republican Party, Party of Business, was very active in support of business. Businesses didn't want government to stay out. They wanted government to get in, and they wanted government to provide positive reinforcement for what they were doing. And government did, which is another one of the reasons that this revolution took off when it did in the United States. It had nothing to do with the business per se, but in 1860, when Abraham Lincoln was elected as a Republican, the South seceded, and all those Southern Democrats left, leaving the federal government in control of this new Republican Party, which was anti-slavery, but also pro-business. And for the next 40 years, there was this party usually in charge of the federal government that was very favorably disposed toward the operation and the development of the capitalist system.
So after the war, there is no longer any slave labor available. There are all these new corporations and factories opening up, and this is a huge draw for European immigrants.
One of the big parts of this story is the fact that immigrant labor made possible this revolution in American economic life. And in those days, there was no such thing as illegal immigration because there were no laws restricting immigration. The policy was anybody who wants to come, come on in. Now, there was one exception to this that started in 1882, and that was there was a law banning Chinese laborers from coming in. And this is an exception that proves the broader rule. In the late 19th century, as today, there were groups that were in favor of immigration and groups that were opposed to immigration. The groups then that were opposed to immigration were primarily workers who realized that the more people who came in willing to work for very low wages, the less chance they, the workers already here, had of raising their own pay scale. And so workers in those days opposed immigration, but they had almost no traction with the political system. In those days, as today, employers like immigration because the more people who come in, the more hands to work in the factories and the lower wages you can get away paying. Now, the fact that there were no important immigration restrictions during that period, with the one exception I mentioned, demonstrates how clearly the ownership class, called the capitalist class, controlled the political system. Things changed by the 1920s, and we've been in a different world since then. But if not for the millions who came in from Europe, it would have been impossible to staff this capitalist revolution. And this was, it was both a cause and effect of the capitalist revolution. And that is, it was a cause. These were the workers who came in. It was an effect because the more jobs there were in America, the greater the draw to immigrants.
So the immigrants who came and stayed and worked in cities changed the character of major U.S. cities, and the ones who pushed past really fueled Western expansion.
It was the dream of very many immigrants who, for the most part, were farmers or peasants in some cases in Europe. It was the dream of most of them. They would come to America and they would get a farm, and they would be able to reconstruct the life that they had had in Europe, only better. Now, the fact of the matter was that relatively few of them ever made it out to the frontier where the cheap land was. Most of them managed to get stuck in the cities. Now, I say get stuck. When they got to the cities, they discovered that there were economic opportunities in the cities. And here's something that's also worth keeping in mind. If you look at the depictions of life among the poor in the big cities of the United States in the 1880s and 1890s, and certainly by modern standards, their conditions were abysmal. Jacob Riis wrote a shocking expose called How the Other Half Lives, showing what life was like in these urban slums. Well, there are two things to keep in mind about this. One is that poverty had always existed in America and in every society. But in agricultural societies, poverty is relatively invisible. The poor live on farms. They live out in the country. They're not gathered together. Poverty in America in the 1880s and 1890s was, for the first time, concentrated. People lived in these slums, in these tenements. And it was often right next to the homes of the wealthy. So you could walk from Millionaire's Row along Park Avenue in New York, and in a 10-minute walk, maybe a 20-minute walk, you could be passing some of the worst slums. So this idea that things had gotten really bad was partly true, but also partly just a new perspective created by this new juxtaposition. But the other thing was that despite these pockets of poverty in America, people still came. And it is one of the strongest arguments in favor of capitalism and in favor of this capitalist revolution that no one was putting a gun to the heads of the European immigrants, say, go to America and take those jobs. And although the jobs seemed to be dirty and dangerous, had long hours and low pay, by comparison to the standards of Americans already here, by comparison to the standards of Europe and the countries from which they came, these were good jobs, and that's why they kept coming.
H.W. Brands is my guest. The new book is called American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900. We'll go to the phones now and speak with Blake in Dallas. Hi, Blake.
Hi, Chris. Enjoying the show very much.
Great.
Particularly very interested in your guest's comments about the tensions between capitalism and democracy. In particular, I'd be interested in hearing his comments on how sometimes through these ideologies, capitalism, democracy, communism, Islam, for example, oftentimes ulterior or other purposes are used under these guises to advance other agendas. For example, the guise of spreading democracy in the Middle East, used from my perspective to advance a capitalistic agenda.
Well, this is a very interesting point that Blake raises. And that is, I said earlier that speakers at patriotic events in America talk of capitalism and democracy as though they're two sides of the same coin. In fact, they don't. Because they never mention capitalism. I've listened to this, and I've been struck by this since I thought about writing the book, how if you asked conservatives, do they believe in capitalism? Do they believe in the principles of capitalism? Almost all of them would say yes. Now, if you ask some liberals, they might say, I've got some questions. But even the defenders of the principles of capitalism shy away from the label, the word. And in fact, I've had some callers on interviews like this say, well, don't use capitalism because that was a label that was invented by leftists during the 19th century. And, you know, maybe so, but in fact, it became the appropriate label for this kind of system. But anyway, there is no question that in American political rhetoric, democracy sounds better than capitalism. And so when President George W. Bush authorized the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and it turned out there weren't weapons of mass destruction, the fallback justification was, we're going to spread democracy. Now, everybody understood that along with democracy, capitalism would spread. But President Bush and almost no one else who supported the invasion of Iraq said, we're doing this to spread capitalism. Now, in fact, they were, but I'm sure they were perfectly sincere in saying, well, we're spreading democracy too. But yeah, it's very interesting. And I guess I should add one other thing about this, and that is that democracy, aside from being based on the principle of equality, seems like the kind of good thing that you want to share with everybody. Who can complain about democracy? But capitalism, well, I said that the fundamental principle of capitalism is inequality. Another way of putting it, it's self-interest. And if you want to put a slightly less charitable spin on self-interest, it's greed. And so if you say you're promoting capitalism, it makes you sound like a greedy person. Whereas if you're promoting democracy, well, that's very altruistic. But this point is very well taken.
Let's talk a little bit about Texas during this period. This has always been good cattle country, presumably. But during the Civil War, of course, northern markets were completely unavailable to Texas ranchers. After the war, there were no limits whatsoever.
Well, yes, and this is the period when Texas becomes connected to the national market. But it takes a while. And at the end of the Civil War, there were herds of millions of wild cattle that had no place to go. They were simply proliferating on the South Texas plains. And some entrepreneurial types realized with the burgeoning cities of the North, there was great demand. There were great appetites for South Texas beef. And the question was, how are you going to get the beef to the market? If there had been railroads to Texas, the beef would have been loaded on the trains, off they would have gone. But the fact is, the railroads hadn't gotten to Texas yet. I said earlier that the South was relatively slow to be knitted to the rest of the country by railroads. And so in the late 1860s, there were no railroads to Texas. And as a result of this lack of railroads, a period in Texas history that became almost synonymous with what Texas was about, even today. Now, this is the era of the long cattle drive. And so the cattle drives would begin in South Texas, and the herds of cattle would wend their way through Texas, cross Oklahoma, then Indian Territory, into Kansas. Why Kansas? Because that's where the railroad was. Now, one of the interesting things about this, although this became almost iconic in Texas history, the period of the cattle drives lasted about a decade, because by then the railroads got to Texas. And so a cattle drive to Fort Worth, which is where many of the cattle were then loaded onto the trains, lacks a lot of romance. It certainly lacks the length of a cattle drive clear to Kansas. And so, just as in Texas history, the period of the Texas Republic becomes mythologized. Well, the Republic of Texas lasted 9 years. Likewise, the era of the cattle drive, just barely a decade. But it left its imprint on the way Texans think of themselves and on the way the rest of the country thinks about Texas.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next on the phones to Ann in Dallas. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I love the show. This is the first time I've listened to it. What I wanted to know is, an African American, I'm curious to know, how does the African American play in the whole idea of capitalism when it came to the Reconstruction era and also the Great Migration?
Thanks for your call. A big part
of
the book.
In fact, this was one of the great challenges facing the country, obviously politically and socially. How do you integrate, or for that matter, do you integrate, because a lot of people oppose this, the former slaves, the African Americans, into the larger national society? There was almost no debate, however, over whether African Americans should be integrated into the national economy. But it was a huge challenge because the great majority of African Americans had been slaves until effectively the end of the Civil War. And as slaves, they lived outside the cash economy. They were required to work. They weren't paid to work. All of a sudden, the compulsion of slavery disappears. And now what are they going to do? For understandable reasons, a lot of slaves, the first thing they did when they heard they were free was just leave the plantations where they had been bound labor for years. But that didn't solve their problem because they still had to, well, they had to find a job. And it had to be a job that would pay them something. But many of the landowners didn't have any cash. And so they came up with a rough and ready solution to this, which was sharecropping. And sharecropping eventually would come to have a really negative connotation because many of the former slaves were cheated by the landowners. But at least initially...
Let me once again have you pause there because we need to take a break. H.W. Brands is with us. His new book is called American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to H.W. Brands about his new book, American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900. And before the break, H.W., you were talking about the evolution of the sharecropping system in the post-war South.
Yeah, as I was saying, after the war, the Southern planters, the people who owned the land, didn't have any cash to pay the laborers, the former slaves, who would be working the land. Because until the Civil War, they had been slaves, and there was no cash transaction. And so in order to solve this problem, how do you give the laborers some incentive to work? They came up with a scheme that would actually be used to great effect over a century later in Silicon Valley. And so the basic idea is, if you want somebody to work for you, but you don't have cash to pay them, what do? Well, you offer them a share of the profits. And in Silicon Valley, this meant you could become a shareholder of, pick your Google, eBay, whatever it is, and people could get really rich. In the 1870s and 1880s in the South, well, the returns weren't quite so great, but the idea was the same, so that the land owners would provide the land, they would provide the tools, they would provide the seed, the laborers would provide the labor, and they would split, they would share the crop. And this is where the term and the practice of sharecropping came. Now, it developed in a relatively short time that the landowners had a lot more leverage in these negotiations than the laborers did. And so very often the contracts were written and were implemented in ways that benefited the landowners and disadvantaged the laborers. But nonetheless, the idea was similar to that would be used a century later in California.
Another thing you write about is the nascent movement during this time by African Americans trying to get full and equal rights in this country. And there were two distinct approaches that you write about here.
In the period from the end of the Civil War until the end of the century, the question of what would be the position of African Americans in American life was relatively open-ended. There were, call them the full egalitarians, who believed that the slaves are no longer slaves, they should become full citizens, and they should have all the rights of citizens. And a fair and close reading of the Reconstruction Amendments to the Constitution, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, which ended slavery, which granted citizenship, and which granted the vote, regardless of race or previous condition of servitude, that should have resolved the issue. But it didn't, because those amendments were passed, more precisely, they were accepted in the South largely under duress. The white majorities in the South were forced to accept these amendments as the price of being readmitted to the Union. But they didn't believe in them. And generations of whites that had grown up believing that whites were superior to blacks had a hard time changing that point of view. And during the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s, whites in the South began to experiment with various schemes for undermining the constitutional guarantees of equality. And what gradually came to pass was something that was called colloquially the Jim Crow system of segregation, in which, without explicitly or overtly denying equality to African Americans, did indeed deny equality in actual practice. And the clearest example of how the country as a whole was accepting this came in 1896 when the Supreme Court ruled in a landmark case called Plessy versus Ferguson. It was about rail transportation in the state of Louisiana. The state of Louisiana had mandated separate cars for African Americans and whites. And the law said nothing about the cars for the blacks being inferior to the cars for the whites. And it just said they're going to be separate. And the Supreme Court, looking at the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection of the laws, read that as saying equal does not require the same or in conjunction. And so the formula of separate but equal was established. The conditions for the different races can be separate as long as they're equal. Well, that was the formula in 1896, but skeptics at the time, including John Marshall Harlan, an associate justice, who dissented in this case, said, it's fine to talk about that in legal theory, but that's not the way the world works, and that's certainly not the way things work in the South. As soon as you allow separate facilities for blacks, those facilities will become inferior. And he said, this simply opens the door to the creation of an entirely segregated system, a caste system in the South, where there will be black churches and black schools and black stores and black restaurants and all of this. He was saying this as a matter of hyperbole, hoping to shame people into changing their minds. But in fact, within 15 years, everything that he had predicted, almost as a way of shocking people, had come to pass.
Hmm. Let's go next to Ted in Tyler. Hi, Ted.
How are you?
Great, thanks.
Capitalism in the past, two questions. Number one, does the guest think that it is understood by the masses as the same? In other words, is capitalism viewed in a positive light or whatever light it was viewed in the past today? And do you think capitalism is good for the country in general? Thanks.
Okay, two questions. First of all, capitalism was always controversial. No, not so controversial that people said, well, we want to overturn it and put in a socialist system. So Americans have always accepted the idea of a market-based system of exchange, relatively free entry into different enterprises, and the ability of people to make whatever the market is willing to pay them. So they've accepted that, and they have not insisted on economic equality. So, however, but within that, there has always been a complaint that some people get really rich and some people stay pretty poor. And it's not as though the really rich people clearly deserve their riches. Sometimes it's a matter of luck. Sometimes, frankly, it's a matter of the markets are rigged in their favors. That was one of the big complaints in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. And, of course, one of the big complaints in the last decade or so, where the bankers that seemed to run the country over the cliff in 2008 walked away with these hundreds of millions of dollars in their pockets. So there's that part. Then the broader question was capitalist good for America? Well, it really depends on how you define good. If the goal of an economy is only to maximize the total gross domestic product in the shortest amount of time, capitalism is the system for you because it did this in the United States. And whereas in the 1830s and 1840s, America was a middling economic power, by 1900, America was the wealthiest, most powerful country in the world. And the American standard of living, I have to be careful, the average American standard of living was higher than it had ever been in any country in any era of history. So if the goal of the economy is simply to produce the most stuff, then capitalism is the system you want. But people recognized then, and they recognize now, that there are at least two potential drawbacks to this. One is the price of this dynamic system that produces this great big pile of wealth is growing inequality. So some people are way richer than others. And if equality is an important value, then you're going to have some second thoughts about unfettered capitalism. And the second is that capitalism on its own tends to be unstable. In the late 19th century, there were a series of financial crises. There was a panic of 1857, and they called them panics in those days. A panic of 1857, a panic of 1873, a panic of 1893. There was another panic in 1907. Of course, there was the great stock market crash of 1929. So capitalism running on its own tends to go through these periods of rapid growth and then collapse. And so if you want stable growth, if that's a value, then you're probably going to have some government regulations or checks. So to say whether capitalism is a good thing or not really is more a reflection on the person making the evaluation and what that person values in terms of overall growth, total wealth, and the corresponding or perhaps the competing values of equality and stability.
Of course, just as we argue today about how much the government should interfere in the activities of capitalist enterprises, there were issues even back in the 19th century with, for example, the price of gold. Can you talk about that?
One of the sources of constant instability and constant distress in the American economy and therefore in broader American life in the last third of the 19th century was the question of money. What does money consist of? And during much of this period, money had two forms in the United States, gold and paper. Now, the paper at one time had originally been backed by gold, so it was equivalent to gold. But during the Civil War, the United States went off a pure gold standard and issued these dollars called fiat money, where they depend simply on the full faith and credit of the government, and they're not backed by anything in particular. And so there was a great debate over, well, should the country go back on gold? Should it rely on these greenbacks? Related to this was the fact that the money supply overall was growing much more slowly than the total economy. Now, a direct consequence of this was that prices were falling. And if you're paying attention to the economy today, you know that one of the big concerns of Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve is to avoid deflation, because deflation has all sorts of negative consequences. Once you get into a deflationary cycle, it's hard to get out. Well, the United States was in a deflationary cycle for 20 years, from the 1870s to the 1890s, and it put real burdens on debtors, because people who owe money are severely hurt by deflation, because the dollars they pay back are worth a lot more than the dollars they borrowed. And farmers in particular were pinched by this. And this was the principal cause for the emergence of a populist protest party of farmers called the Populist Party. And anybody who's paying attention today to the Tea Party movement and wants to know where this idea of Tea Party protest came from, they didn't use the term Tea Party in the 1880s and 1890s, but the idea of popular protest against the general trend of affairs more than against specific policies goes right back to that period. And if you want to know where the tea parties are going, pay attention to what happened to the populace in the 1880s and 1890s.
We have time for one more quick call. We will speak with Jason in Fort Worth. Hi, Jason.
Hi. Had a comment and a question. My original question was about the title of the book, but the previous caller, I kind of got an answer out of his answer to that. So my comment is, it strikes me odd that to hear you say, well, capitalism is good depending on where you, how you approach it. It's kind of like saying, you know, if I wanted to, if somebody came and pinched me really hard, well, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it depends on the person pinching you and what they're getting out of it. So that's my comment. My question was, how would you refute or not the idea that everybody using the word capitalism right now is not even in its true sense, let's say via Howard Zinn or Noam Chomsky? And that'd be my question.
Thanks, Gerkel. Okay.
Well, I'll respond to your first comment about, you know, is it a good or bad thing? The reason that the answer is complicated is that you're asking the question of as many people as live in the United States. So you're talking 75 million people in the United States at the beginning of the 20th century, 300 million today. And if somebody is really benefiting from capitalism, they say it's a good thing. If somebody's a loser from capitalism, they say it's a bad thing. So how do you form an overall judgment that brings in all this stuff? That's why I made sort of the qualified answer that I did. Now, in terms of what exactly is capitalism? The United States has never had a capitalist system as theoretically defined in terms of a pure free market. In fact, one of the striking things about the capitalist emergence in the late 19th century was how in very many fundamental ways the capitalists were themselves the worst enemies of capitalism. One of the principal arguments in favor of capitalism is competition. And it forces entrepreneurs to deliver goods and services efficiently. Well, people like John Rockefeller had no use for competition whatsoever. He thought competition was inefficient. He spent his entire life trying to crush competition. He believed that he should be the czar of the oil refining business. And if people would simply hand control of the business to him, the whole industry to him, the world would be better off. Now, in some ways, he was right, because he was a genius at the organizational efficiencies required to get the most out of a barrel of oil.
We've got just seconds left, so if you could wrap up.
But people became very uneasy at handing that kind of control to one person who wasn't elected anything by anybody.
H.W. Brands is Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History at UT. His new book is called American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900. H.W., thank you so much for being on the show today.
It was my pleasure, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.